Why are the majority of the world's mining companies headquartered in Canada? Why is it so difficult for Canadian mining companies to be held accountable for their destructive practices and abuses of human rights in places like Guatemala? How deeply invested are Canadians in predatory mining companies? What are the intimidation tactics being employed to blunt community resistance? Do women have a special role in this movement? How much assistance are Indigenous communities in Guatemala getting from non-Indigenous Guatemalans and the larger global community? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we draw attention to the dark underbelly of one of Canada's most lucrative and destructive industries, the mining sector, and how it threatens the social and environmental well-being of communities in Guatemala and all over the Global South. We'll hear from Jen Moore of the watchdog organization Mining Watch Canada, and we'll hear from a Mayan land defender and an ally from the ecumenical organization Kairos about the Indigenous resistance against this corporate encroachment. On today's show, Canadian mining industry abuses in Guatemala and how Indigenous communities are fighting back. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 29th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Last week, former NSA intelligence analyst John Schindler posted a rather disturbing tweet with a statement that one could only assume to be a reference towards Russia. Schindler wrote, quote, said a senior NATO non-US GOFO to me today, quote, we'll probably be at war this summer. If we're lucky, it won't be nuclear, unquote. Let that sink in, unquote. That comes from the article, Senior NATO Official Claims We'll Be at War by Summer, by Joshua Krauss, posted May 28th, originally appearing at The Daily Sheeple. The growing segment of the American population is waking up to the implications of the Jade Helm 15 military operation to be conducted by special forces in conjunction with local law enforcement, the FBI, DHS, the DEA, and Border Patrol across the entire Southwest. This massive, unprecedented exercise will also commence in June, sooner than first announced, and last for 10 weeks through the summer till September 15th. We also are aware of the globalists' long-planned agenda of a national crisis that would induce Obama to quash civil unrest by declaring martial law. A recent poll of Americans found that near half, 45%, see Jade Helm as imposing more control over the states. If martial law doesn't actually come to pass this time around, it certainly sets the stage for next time in this incrementally increasing militarization of America. That comes from the article, Towards a Militarized Police State in America? Explosive New Revelations Over Jade Helm 15 Exercise and Potential False Flags by Joachim Hagopian, posted May 27th. The ocean is dying, by all accounts, and if so, the food supply along with it. The causes are numerous and overlapping. Natural causes in the environment are partly to blame. So too are the corporations of man. The effects of Fukushima, unleashing untold levels of radiation into the ocean and onto Pacific shores, the cumulative effect of modern chemicals and agricultural waste tainting the water and disrupting reproduction. A startling new report says in no uncertain terms that the Pacific Ocean off the California coast is turning into a desert. Once full of life, it is now becoming barren, and marine mammals, seabirds, and fish are starving as a result. That comes from the article, The Ocean is Dying, Marine and Animal Life Die-Offs, California Coast, by Max Slavel, posted May 27th, originally appearing at the SHTF plan. Getting back to China, whenever they do make an announcement of how much gold they have, the yuan will appreciate greatly versus all fiat currencies. Many will poo-poo this thought because China will never do that. They will kill their own manufacturing base. The Chinese are very smart people. They can see the West is hitting the debt wall. They also know that as the wall is hit and markets begin to implode, their customers are going to have an even harder time buying Chinese-produced goods. They already know this is happening and can see it in their trade figures, which is why they recently formed the AIIB and are working feverishly to open the old Silk Road trade route. That comes from the article, Collapsing Global Economy, Imploding Financial System, China Has Only One Option, by Bill Holter, posted May 27th. The USA has spent many trillions of dollars during the last decade alone on its defense against these dangerous terrorists all over the world. And it is this defense which, without provocation, bombed to smithereens more than half a dozen Muslim countries and thus caused the profuse stream of refugees to the affluent countries of the EU. Incidentally, it is now well known that both Al-Qaeda and ISIS were created, funded, trained, and armed by the CIA and other U.S. security and military agencies themselves in order to stir up violence that could then be used as excuses to intervene with military force toward covert political and financial ends, all according to objective international analysts, coinciding with highly credible sources within the U.S. establishment itself. Is it then reasonable to expect small countries like Sweden to tacitly accept the responsibility of caring for the resulting destitute refugees? That comes from the article, Swedish Politician, U.S. is the True Cause of the Masses of Refugees from the Middle East, by Jens Jerndahl, spokesman for the political party Unity, posted May 27th, originally appearing in News Voice. The Yemeni army, backed by popular committee forces, has destroyed four Saudi battle tanks after storming a base in Saudi Arabia's southwestern city of Jizan. Yemen's Arabic language Al-Masira satellite television network reported the development late on Monday. It also reported that the Yemeni army targeted three Saudi vehicles in the southwestern Saudi city of Najran, which is located near the border with Yemen, with rockets and artillery shells. The Syrian army has launched a major offensive against the ISIL Takfiri terrorists who recently overran the city of Palmyra in central Homs province. According to the military sources, the Air Force struck more than 160 Islamic State targets, killing and wounding terrorists and destroying weapons and vehicles equipped with machine guns. That comes from the article, Yemen Armed Forces Strike Back Against Saudi Aggression, Syrian Army Offensive Against ISIL, by South Front, posted May 27th. Instead of going after war criminals, CIA and Pentagon torturers, banker mega crooks, other corporate thieves, corrupt politicians on the take, dirty cops, and other major U.S. offenders demanding prosecution, Washington targeted the Zurich, Switzerland-based International Federation of Association Football, FIFA, outside its jurisdiction. It's pressuring Swiss authorities to extradite FIFA officials to America to face criminal corruption charges. The timing of the indictments and arrests wasn't coincidental. 2 days before FIFA's annual general meeting with its officials in one place at a luxury Zurich hotel. Russia's foreign ministry responded sharply to Washington's indictments, saying it extended its legal authority improperly, quote, far beyond its borders, unquote. Putin called FIFA indictments, quote, an obvious attempt to spread U.S. jurisdiction to other states and prevent Mr. Blatter's re-election, which is a gross violation of the principle of functioning international organizations, unquote. That comes from the article, Washington Wages War on International Soccer, by Stephen Lenman, posted May 28th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Canada is home to 75% of the world's mining and exploration companies, and Canadian stock exchanges raise 40% of all mineral exploration capital worldwide. These companies have been linked to violence committed against Indigenous communities in the regions they operate. That's according to the group Kairos. Kairos is a Canadian-based ecumenical organization which brings together 12 churches around human rights and environmental justice work. Grassroots activists have been taking action against these exploitive companies. Regular Canadians are by and large unaware of the horrific injustices committed at the behest of these companies, including gang rape, murder, and the degradation of waterways and land. We'll hear first from an Indigenous land defender and a Kairos representative with whom she is allied and will function as her translator. Ana Guadalupe Madzir Mikulax is a Mayan from Chimaltenango, Guatemala. Currently, she is a student of legal and social sciences and works with SEBA, the Association for Community Development and Promotion in Guatemala. Ana Guadalupe was networking with churches and other groups attempting to raise awareness about the human rights crisis in Guatemala. Rachel Warden is the coordinator of the Latin American Partnerships and Gender Justice Program of Kairos's Canadian Ecumenical Justice Initiatives. The two women spoke at a community event at the University of Winnipeg on May 27, 2015. The talk was geared toward acquainting Winnipeggers with how Guatemalan Indigenous communities are fighting back against Canadian mining companies. I had a chance to interview the two women after the talk. I know, Ana Guadalupe, that you started, you were very young, about 13, and I'm wondering if you might wish to share a particular incident that might have really mobilized you and got you wanting to work for justice for your people. Is there anything a particular outrage that you may wish to share with our listeners that stuck with you?
Bueno, yo empecé de muy joven, hace muchos años. Lo que me motivó.
So I started this work when I was very young. When I was 13 years out, 7 years ago. And I lived in an area where there wasn't much information about what was going on. In the human rights situation or the environmental impacts. And so I had the opportunity at that age to participate in workshops, and I left the community and learned about different cases. And the one case that really struck me at that time was the case of the Marlin mine and Montana Resources and the Marlin mine.
Entonces, cuando empecé a ver toda esa situación, me sentí como muy triste al ver también de que muchos jóvenes, la juventud, o sea.
So I saw the situation of the impact of the Marlin mine and on the community. But what saddened me was that the young people weren't involved. They weren't involved in the organization or the resistance. It was mainly the adults. And so I decided to get involved at that early age, and I did research, and I actually made a video about the situation. And I learned more in this way. I learned more about what was going on, about the criminalization of people, about the human rights violations, particularly the violations against women. I saw as well the damages that the mine was causing, the houses that had been destroyed. And this is what got me involved in the first place in this work, and I continue in this struggle.
Could you talk about the when the Canadian mining companies in particular became a significant concern? I'm curious to know how much the situation, the human rights concerns and the community intrusions have worsened since the Canadian mining giants got involved.
Bueno, se inició en el caso de minería se empezó a ver desde como el año.
So the mining really started in 2001, the Marlin mine began to buy land for the construction of the land. And people began to realize the impacts and organize. And people were also aware of their rights, particularly becoming more and more aware of their rights, particularly the right to free prior informed consent, as it enshrined in the International Labor Organization Article 169, and it wasn't being respected. So the people began to organize and demand recognition of this right. They had a consultation; it wasn't recognized. But because they knew that that this was a right, they continued to demand it. And this resistance, this peaceful resistance based on the right to free, prior, informed consent, has grown in Guatemala. So now there's over 70 consultations, community consultations, that have taken place, in which more than a million people have participated and expressed their, in most cases, their rejection of these projects.
I have a question about the challenges of organizing in the country. The landscape, there's a lot of different communities that are fairly remote and in some cases difficult to get to. There's maybe you having to overcome, I think what you mentioned in your speech at the University of Winnipeg, intimidation. I'm wondering if you can comment on and help Canadians and the wider public understand just how difficult the kind of work you're doing really is.
Bueno, son varios los las dificultades que se ha tenido por resistir, porque ha sido como varias cosas. La persecución, o sea, se compran, los empresarios compran voluntades.
So the difficulties are various and numerous. People face persecution. There's efforts by the companies to try and buy people off. People are threatened. They're criminalized, as I said. They suffer from threats of assassination, and women are raped.
Que la gente se ha preocupado bastante. Han creado mucha división en las comunidades, porque con eso mucha gente que tiene miedo acepta los megaproyectos.
As well, the companies have created divisions, deep divisions in the community, where people who are afraid or often intimidated, or will accept the these projects, and this division has been very strong and has had a real impact on communities. But people continue to resist and to resist peacefully, and these are the people who are defending life. And they continue in this struggle, knowing that they face all these risks, and they might even face death, but they continue to struggle for life.
On that note, Anna, you've been involved in this work with SIBA for about 8 years, and you're still a very young woman. I'm wondering if you could share with me if there was a particular incident, maybe a close friend, a family member, somebody you were active with, who was in fact victimized in some way, whether it was rape or murder. Is there something that might have really hit home for you that you could share?
Bueno, Pues en realidad es como
so the reality is that in Guatemala we are moving to this idea of buen vivir or living well or living with enough, and part of that is respect for nature and everything that's around us, and that we are all a part of it. We're all a part of this this vision, this world vision, and we're all family as well. So we're all brothers and sisters. So to sort of ask about a personal incident involves thinking about everybody. We're all part of buen vivir. So when somebody suffers, one person suffers, when the environment suffers, we all suffer. We all suffer. So the community is everybody, and the struggle is everyone, and we're all impacted by it. So when the river is contaminated, it affects all of us. And this is when we can see with climate change as well. So this the idea is that we are all one in this struggle for life. And so that's what motivates me, and that's what motivates me to continue in this struggle as well. There's sort of a strong sense of I feel a strong sense of solidarity. And there's, she's talked about the recent incident in La Puya, which is an incident she spoke about last night, where there's been peaceful resistance for a couple of years around a mining company, a peaceful resistance to prevent the mining company from entering, and the solidarity around that has been very strong, and I feel strong solidarity around the people who are there resisting peacefully.
Now, just to expand on that subject of solidarity, Rachel, you're here in solidarity. I am curious about how, within Guatemala itself, that solidarity between the indigenous population and the non-indigenous settler population. Do we have those sorts of strong alliances, or? Do you have to work against whether it's misunderstandings or prejudices or other sorts of factors like that?
Bueno, la solidaridad ha sido muy visible porque hay varias instituciones de derechos humanos, personas individuales también que luchan por el respeto de los derechos humanos. Entonces,
so the solidarity in Guatemala has been quite visible. It's seen in the human rights organizations that exist, as well as kind of an organizational level, as well as the individuals who are struggling for respect for human rights. And this is seen at a national and an international level, tours and delegations. Are organized to accompany communities that are in resistance.
Duerme, ahí comen, ahí se turnan en toda la comunidad, se turnan por días, están 24 horas, y así van cambiando de turnos hasta que, o sea, hay resistencias que ya llevan ya hasta 3 años viviendo ahí.
For example, in the community of La Puya, people come. People, nationals and also international people come and join us there in this sort of occupation of the area. They join us in this sort of constant resistance. For example, in La Puya, they've been there for 3 years, living like this. Non-indigenous, indigenous, international people come and they join these expressions of resistance. They bring food, they bring clothing, so you can see that solidarity is very concrete and also very, very visible. So it's also seen, this solidarity is also seen in petitions and in letter writing campaigns, letters to the government that come from international that are sent out internationally, and that as well at a sort of international multilateral level, these human rights abuses are being denounced at the UN, at the Inter-American Human Rights Commission.
Okay, so I think that maybe I'll just I'll direct a question to you, Rachel, about the efforts by Kairos to assist in these in the solidarity efforts? What's been the extent of Kairos's involvement? How did it get tuned into this issue, and what's its current campaign?
Well, Kairos, we work with partners all over the world and in Canada. We do work in research, in advocacy, and also in direct support for partners. But our work is always informed by partners. And so our work, and that's how we arrive at the mining issue, our work is informed by partners. The mining is impacting the rights and the environment and the communities of partners. And so that's what we're responding to. And our work is really bringing that reality and those concerns here to Canada in our education and in our advocacy in our advocacy work. So working with SEBA, bringing Ana Guadalupe here to Canada to talk about the reality of what's going on in Guatemala, which is a very different reality from what we're hearing from our government, from what we hear from mining companies. So that's a large part of my work is simply that, bringing those voices here to Canada, making those struggles visible here, because often we don't hear them through the mainstream media. We don't hear them from our governments or the mining companies. So another part of our work in solidarity is also reciprocity, I think. And another, I just wanted to mention as well that Ana Guadalupe and I, after our trip to Winnipeg, we're going on to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the closing event in Ottawa, and the release of the final report. And this is a very important process that's going on in Canada, a human rights process, a process of truth and reconciliation that some of our partners, including partners in Guatemala, have experienced in Guatemala. So at this time, we're calling on our Guatemalan partners to be here in Canada for this very important event, to be witnesses, international witnesses, for this very important and historic event in Canada.
Okay. I think we're just about at the end of our time. I just wanted to make sure each of you had a chance to express maybe a final thought, something you really feel compelled to speak to before we close this interview. Anna?
Pues agradecerles la oportunidad que nos han dado, este espacio, para dar a conocer la situación que se vive en Guatemala. Y porque ha sido una forma también de cómo llamar a la gente para que se una también y que vea lo que está pasando, porque los medios masivos pues no difunden este tipo de información. Entonces, pues en estos espacios
I just wanted to say thank you for this opportunity and this space to share what's going on in Guatemala. Because this is what I'm sharing with you, it doesn't often get into the mainstream media. So I really appreciate this opportunity to speak on the radio station about what's going on, and also call on people to express their solidarity and become involved in solidarity with Guatemala, to sign petitions, to deepen their knowledge of what's going on. Because we will continue in this struggle for life, and we're counting on kind of international solidarity to help us with that.
Well, Ana Guadalupe Matsir Mikulax, Rachel Warden, gracias. Thank you very much for being our guest, and safe travels on your continuing journey.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. To put the Canadian mining sector's abusive practices towards Guatemalan and other countries in the Global South in some context, we're joined now by Jen Moore. She is the Latin America Program Coordinator for Mining Watch Canada.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe one or two of the more outstanding examples of mining companies and the not just the, you know, neglectful activity, but just out and out abuse that the Canadian public, by and large, is not aware of.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when we're talking about Guatemala, there's unfortunately an abundant number of examples, but perhaps one of the most notorious, I would say, in certain ways right now, is what's going on with Tahoe Resources project in southeastern Guatemala. And I say that because Tahoe Resources is a spin-off project, a spin-off company from Goldcorp. And so first to just give a little bit about what's gone on with Goldcorp and then to explain what's going on with Tahoe and why I think it's so notorious is that the one came before the other. So Goldcorp set up its Marlin mine, the first open pit, large-scale open pit gold and silver mine, to go into operation in Guatemala since the peace accords in 1996. It was around this time that neoliberal amendments were made to the mining code in Guatemala to really enable and encourage foreign investment in the mining sector again. And Canada was right there with his companies to take advantage of that. And really, you know, with support from the Canadian embassy, Goldcorp got its Marlin mine underway in the context of tremendous resistance from Mayan indigenous communities in the surrounding municipalities of San Miguel Ixtahuacán and Sipacapa. Mm-hmm. So there were immediate violations of their indigenous rights, lack of free and prior informed consent of those communities before the mine was established. And there's been a series of abuses since. We've seen cases of violence and criminalization. There was four women who stood up, eight women who stood up to the mine after Crisanta Perez, who was a young woman who was complaining to the company about having put an electrical post on her land without her permission, and she was complaining about that. And when she got no response, she cut the power to the mine for a few days. The police responded immediately, and the power was turned on again at the mine. But she and seven women who stood with her in solidarity with her faced warrants out for their arrest for 4 years, causing them tremendous grief and stress because of the complaints that had presented the company, a case of serious criminalization that really had quite negative ramifications on them during this time, although they've gone through tremendous, I think, transformative kind of response since there's been really good efforts by Guatemalan organizations to get those charges lifted. There's also serious concerns about the health and water impacts of that mine operation. But what's going on now with Tahoe Resources in southeastern Guatemala, I would say they've learned all the worst lessons from Marlin. So the indigenous communities faced by the impacts of the Marlin mine brought them to the most prestigious international human rights bodies that there are, at the regional level, at the international level, talking about the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington, to the regional body, as well as to the Committee of Experts at the International Labor Organization in Geneva, and numerous of these institutions called for the suspension of the Marlin mine and called for the attention and guarantee of the public health, the water, and the indigenous rights of the local communities. None of that has been respected to up until today, after lengthy and quite persistent efforts on the part of communities with a diverse range of allies.
Mm-hmm.
Tahoe now, which in just in the last few years has gotten a silver mine set up, has used tremendous amounts of criminalization from way before the mine went into operation. It's a militarized site. There's been multiple murders, and we're seeing, I would say, evidence of increasing intensification of criminalization and militarization around mine and mega hydroelectric projects that's happening Guatemala-wide, taking place in that case, as well as others.
Can you talk a little bit more about that quasi-military infrastructure and who's being involved? I mean, I think there was a major exposure of this just late last year.
Yeah. So we've been gathering more information about this as a result of the fact that Tahoe Resources is now being sued in BC courts for an incident of violence that took place in April of 2013 when private security guards shot on peaceful protesters outside of the mine and wounded seven men. So those seven men have now brought a lawsuit for negligence and battery against the company in British Columbia. And we're currently waiting for a decision on some recent hearings to know whether or not that case will proceed and whether or not the BC courts will accept jurisdiction over that case. But the filings that have been submitted to court, some of the declarations from one of the vice presidents of Tahoe Resources and others, have helped to reveal what this quasi-military security apparatus is all about. So it wasn't the head. So in part, we knew that the head of security for private security for the mine was this ex-Marine from Peru that had training in counterinsurgency and had been linked to some of the development of criminalization strategies that were revealed through some documentation that was obtained by human rights observers in the country. But what we've been learning through the filings on that lawsuit has been that well before the company put its mine into operation, which was in early 2014, so we're talking about 2011, and this is a time when communities and municipalities are fervently trying to undertake popular consultation processes or plebiscites at the municipal level in order to express their democratically organized and expressed opinion about mining on their territories, in which we've got now six municipalities in the immediately surrounding area where tens of thousands of people have voted against this mine operation and any mining on their territory. But in the immediate municipality where Tahoe Resources is operating, San Rafael Las Flores, very early on, a strategy of criminalization targeting the local leaders that were promoting the plebiscites and was undertook. And we know now that from 2011, from around this time when they were really trying to promote this consultation process in San Rafael Las Flores, that the company had developed its security strategy with the help from defense and security contractors in the U.S. that have experience developing contracts and security plans for companies working in Iraq and Afghanistan, that it was around this time that it developed a relationship with this ex-Navy Marine from Peru, who was then contracted directly through an Israeli-based security outfit in Guatemala called the Grupo Golan, and that from very early on, this aggressive, intentional apparatus was put in place that had all of the trappings to undertake a very deliberate, I think, strategy of singling out and sort of destabilizing local organizing going on of local land and environmental offenders in the area.
Hmm. The Escobal mining project became listed as a, quote, strategic natural resource, and thereby enabling this kind of militarization. I find that a little concerning, since this recent bill C-51 is that's being going through the Canadian Parliament talks about the need to protect the security of Canada, and then just sort of similar language. Are we seeing, when we look at what's happening in Guatemala and in Latin America, are we potentially seeing parallel developments happening here in Canada?
Anything? I definitely believe so. And maybe I'll just flesh out a little bit what you're referring to, because it's actually important to understanding the militarization of the Escobal project as well. That at the time that Tahoe Resources had been ramping up and developing its project, we've had a former military general in the presidency in Guatemala with a very, what Guatemalans would deem a very militarized sort of government apparatus. And there's been close relationships between the company and that government. And around the time that the shooting took place that Tahoe is now being sued for, the Guatemalan government, with help from the company, set up a pilot project in the local municipality where the mine is located, that's headed by the National Security Commission, that, as you say, declared you know, this project to be in the national interest and anybody who is opposing it to be a threat to the national interest and a threat to national security. So justifying the militarization of the site, there was a state of siege that was put in temporarily, but there's been ongoing military presence, soldiers present in the immediate area since that time. And that project, that pilot project, continues under the direction of a military colonel. And local activists really look at it as a counter-insurgency and a military intelligence operation. In terms of parallels with Canada, I definitely believe that the sort of intensification of criminalization of dissent that we're seeing, not just in Guatemala, but really across the Latin American region, and especially against those that are contesting the economic development model that they're up against right now, is very much coming home, as Canada has also sought sort of a race to the bottom in terms of, you know, serious setbacks on its environmental laws, serious setbacks in terms of public participation and especially First Nations participation in decisions being made over mega projects on their lands and territories, and that in reaction to the growing pushback on this in Canada, that we're seeing measures like Bill C-51 that will enable the intelligence services here, the police and the government, to more heavily monitor and surveil people who are contesting corporate interests. In this country that our government has come to serve. And I think that, you know, it's not a new thing that there's criminalization of dissent here, but the intensification of that and the sorts of measures that the government is putting in place through this bill are very disturbing, and I do think are happening in parallel to the sort of criminalization that we're seeing as governments through the Latin American region as well reinforce their dependency on natural resource extraction sort of at any cost.
Is there something that makes Canada a more attractive place to headquarter its Canadian mining companies as opposed to countries like the United States or Germany or wherever?
Mm-hmm. I definitely think that Canada has set itself up to be a key source of, or a key sort of place in which headquartering and obtaining easy financing is easier. For instance, to list on the Toronto Stock Exchange, the rules you have to follow are much more lax than they are in the U.S. And that contributes. That is what contributes to the fact that we've got 75% of the world's mining corporations registered and listed in Canada. About 60% are listed on Toronto Stock Exchange. Not all companies publicly list their shares. What's important about those 60% of companies, 90% of them don't have any mine actually in operation. So what we've really been financing, what we've really been sort of stimulating, is the most speculative phase of mining, which is the exploration, the prospecting and exploration phase of mining. The Canadian government does that through various ways, not just the lax listing rules for the Toronto Stock Exchanges, but also through, especially when it comes to exploration in Canada, which is the principal destination for mining exploration investments around the world, it has tools such as flow-through shares, where companies, because they're not actually registering any profits when they're only engaged in exploration, can actually pass on their expenses to the individual investors in their company so that they can write off those expenses off of their personal tax returns. So there's that measure has been in place since 2008. It was introduced as an emergency measure, but it's been approved year after year. There's other things, too. I think that there's other features in terms of Canada's tremendous commitment to supporting the infrastructure of impunity that Canadian mining companies enjoy when they work abroad. Not only in Canada do we lack mechanisms to hold companies to account when they are implicated in serious abuses abroad, but the Canadian government also goes to great lengths through its embassies, through the channeling of its overseas development aid, through the channeling of loans and insurance through Export Development Canada, to support companies, regardless of the devastating impacts that their operations have and could have on the communities in which they're operating, be that in Latin America, on the African continent, or in Asia Pacific. We have seen since 2013, the Canadian government has had a very explicit strategy through the Global Markets Action Plan to something that it calls economic diplomacy, in which it's dedicating 100% of Canada's overseas missions, so its embassies, to the furthering of private interests. And when we look at how the bulk of private interests in many countries around the world are in the mining sector, that adds up to more diplomatic services and trade commissioner services, which can run a range of things from helping them, you know, get lawyers, troubleshoot, put pressure on local politicians in order to help facilitate permitting processes, and turning a blind eye when serious abuses are taking place, and standing up for them even when they've been implicated, even in murder. So I think, you know, we've got sort of a suite of benefits in addition to the fact that there's been a lot of mining going on in Canada for a long time, and so there's a lot of available services, lawyers, brokers, and other sort of technicians that are readily at hand for companies that set up, be that in Vancouver, Toronto, or other parts of the country.
Why is it so difficult to launch successful lawsuits against these companies?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, logistically and cost-wise, and finding lawyers willing to take it on is always a challenge. It's not easy for campesino farmers or indigenous peoples living in remote and impoverished parts of Latin America or Africa or elsewhere to bring a suit in Canada. Nonetheless, there are some very creative and persistent and important efforts being undertaken by some public interest law firms in Toronto, like Clip and Steins, to bring these suits and to test Canadian courts. And they would argue that Canadian courts haven't been tested enough. And right now what we're seeing is a suite of suits, starting with the three suits against Hudbay Minerals that have been brought in Ontario by Guatemalan plaintiffs, including the widow of a man who was shot and killed by security guards at a mine site formerly owned by Hudbay, and amongst other suits, a young man who was paralyzed in that same day of shooting and aggression, and a separate incident where 11 women were gang raped by private security guards. They have brought a suite of three suits against Hudbay Minerals for negligence. So what they're testing, not is who pulled the trigger in Guatemala, but rather what decisions were made in Toronto through acts or omissions that contributed, that in which Hudbay, through its acts or omissions, contributed to the violence that took place in Guatemala. There's already been precedent-setting decision in that case to allow it to go forward, to allow a parent company to be considered for its responsibility in connection with a subsidiary in another country. And they're now in the stage of discovery where they're able to access more information and heading toward trial, still at a date that's unclear, and probably down the road a ways, a year or so anyway. Mm-hmm. So those are tough cases, though. They're, you know, it's not just Clip and Steins that, you know, is doing a lot of pro bono work and a lot of, you know, media work and fundraising work to keep that case going. You've also got organizations like Rights Action that are accompanying those communities, keeping it visible and supporting the plaintiffs who, you know, are still living with the threats and the struggles, the local struggle for land rights that continues in the face of a new company that has bought up that project, a Russian firm. So there's just, you know, they're long, they're lengthy, they're tiring processes. But that said, there are a number of groups of lawyers and legal groups in Canada that are starting to figure out how to bring these things forward, and we're optimistic that we're going to see more of these suits. And last year there was two more launched, this time in British Columbia for the first time, first against Tahoe Resources and also against Nevsun in connection with forced labor in Eritrea. Hmm. So we'll see. Those are at very preliminary stages, and so far none of these suits have been successful in getting through to a settlement or a sentence. And we know that worldwide, the suits that have been brought, say, in the UK, in the United States, and elsewhere, tend to end in settlements rather than sentences. So it's a long, long road to really get to a judgment. And meanwhile, communities remain in struggle and have to be dealing with these challenges on both fronts. So I think, you know, they do create a lot of obstacles. It doesn't solve the issue of, you know, how to prevent these harms before they happen. It could have, I think, a dissuading effect, and hopefully it will. And I do think that these suits are resonating throughout the industry and throughout the legal community that advises the industry, you know, sort of saying, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost in terms of parent companies are going to be held responsible for the the activities of their subsidiaries in other parts of the world, and the fiction that there's a disconnect between, you know, these pieces of the same company is getting broken down, getting whittled down through these sorts of cases.
You know, Jen, helping to pay for the legal bills of Tahoe and Goldcorp and then these other companies is Canadians through their pension investments, their mandatory pension investments through the CPP Investment Board. How important is the Canadian mining sector ultimately to the Canadian economy?
That's a really good question, and I don't feel like I yet have a really good answer for that. Canada has all sorts of double taxation agreements in place where, you know, companies will choose the jurisdiction where they're going to pay less taxes and lowest royalties. So if they're paying taxes somewhere else, they're not obliged to pay them here. And so the benefits that would be returned from an operation like that presumably would go principally to the company's executives and shareholders and to its direct employees. There was a recent exposé here in Ontario about how effective royalty levels in Ontario, for instance, are 1.5%, and that, like, the Victor Diamond Mine, for instance, has paid all of $224 in royalties since it's been in operation in near Attawapiskat in northern Ontario. Levels of corporate taxes and levels of royalties across this country are dismally low. Canada really has set itself up as a haven for mining firms, whether they're operating here or elsewhere, and has been giving away, you know, non-renewable mineral resources for decades, and at the detriment of the local communities, and certainly at the cost of the public at large that is paid in large part for the infrastructure and for the other inputs, electricity and other things that they need to work. I think pretty low, and that information is generally hard to get at.
Okay, I wanted to put at least one more question to you, because I think it's important, because there was a recent announcement of something, a federally funded institute called the Canadian Institute for Extractive Industries and Development. Mm-hmm. It claims to work with national, regional, and local governments to facilitate resource extraction while maintaining sustainable growth and reducing poverty. I know Mining Watch has researched this institute, and I'm wondering what you can tell us about how you see it working to either mitigate or enable these abusive mining practices.
Yes, so it's actually gone through a name change, I think, since a student group was developed to challenge the institute. It's called Stop the Institute, and they have a website, stoptheinstitute.ca. But they've also done a tremendous amount of work and analysis and access to information requests. What it is, so it's now called the Canadian International Resources Development Institute. It's based at UBC and Simon Fraser University, also in collaboration with the Polytechnique in Quebec, in Montreal. And it was set up in 2013 with $25 million of overseas development aid through the then, as it was then known, the Canadian International Development Agency, that's now been amalgamated into the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. It was set up with the intention, as Minister Fantino at the time said, to be the biggest and best ambassador for the Canadian mining embassy, mining industry, and with the intention of working to influence policies and institutions in other countries related to natural resources governance. And if we look at the trend over the last 10, 15, 20 years of what Canada's interventions in policies and institutions in other countries look like, it has been to entrench and deepen the neoliberal mining model in those countries, which is incredibly puts communities in incredibly disfavorable position. It also tends to privatize sectors, to lower taxes in royalty regimes, and to loosen and make it easier to get mine permits rather than making it, favoring consideration in the first place of the environment, human rights, and local development visions. This is the basic sort of mandate that it has, and the $25 million was just seed money. So there was an intention from the get-go, and there already was from the get-go some private industry funding, some initial commitments of 60 strategic partners, which also included quite a number of university faculties from across the country, and with the intention for further tying research monies on the interests of the Canadian extractive sector in the international realm, and trying to do operationalize Canadian foreign policy that has a long track record through a pseudo-academic institute. In terms of what it has actually been doing, we haven't looked at depth at too many of its projects, and there's some question about how much it's actually been accomplishing. We know that it's been putting some priority on Peru, on Mongolia, which are very troubled countries in terms of their mining and extractive sectors, and that they've been setting up strategic relationships with other academic institutes that are, for instance, we know in the case of Peru, pretty middle of the road and unlikely to diverge too much from the status quo. What else can I tell you? There's also an advisory committee that's made up of government, industry, and other sectors that advises the executive committee of that institute. And so I think it's just, it was really clear to us from the get-go that this pseudo-academic institute lacks independence, has a mandate that is aligned with the government's foreign policy, with the industry's interests, and will, sort of serve, help to be an academic whitewash for business as usual.
Okay. Well, Jen Moore, I really appreciate, you've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate the insights you've shared with our listeners today. Thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for your interest.
And we've been joined by Jen Moore. She's the Latin America Program Coordinator for Mining Watch Canada. Their website is www.miningwatch.ca.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Technical assistance this week was provided by CKUW programmer Julian Cooper. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.